Last week, we kind of ended before the end of the outline, so I wanted to finish a little of that, and we also didn't, I didn't give out a couple fill-in-the-blanks last week. So before we get into this week's notes, week four, I'd like you to check out week three and open that up and open up the fill-in-the-blanks portion, and I'll give you the ones that I missed. I somehow was going a little too fast or something. And then we'll finish the outline on page 37 of 39. And that would be page 100 in the upper right-hand corner. So this is, again, finishing up last week's week three material on the manuscript evidence under historical evidence, page 37 of 39 and page 100 in the upper right-hand corner. And when we finish this, we'll get into the PowerPoint presentation above for the week four material. Now, I've heard a few pieces of feedback to slow down when I'm giving out the fill-in-the-blanks, so I'll try to do a better job at that. But tonight we actually don't have fill-in-the-blanks, so we're going to be working through the PowerPoint tonight and showing some pictures. It's not that exciting, but it'll give you, you know, a picture speaks louder than a thousand words. Is that the right way to say it? Picture's worth a thousand words. So that's kind of the idea with that. So we'll cover that. And then the email I sent out, hopefully you got my email. I tried to explain that the fill-in-the-blank handout last week had some gray highlighted areas. The gray highlighted areas do not correspond in any way to the book. It's new material, and that's why it's grayed out. It's kind of to give you an indication in your mind that that material is new. So the fill-in-the-blanks has some new material. It's in gray, and that's why it's that way, to just be an indicator for you. And so we'll cover that in a moment. Now, I also passed around some books and magazines. If you have those, keep them rolling through. And we'd love to see everybody look at them briefly, at least. There are some archaeological magazines from the Biblical Archaeological Society, I believe. And there's a Dead Sea Scrolls book going around with some great pictures in it. We talked about the Dead Sea Scrolls last week and the significance of those. And there's also another Biblical Archaeology book going around as well as a Bible Atlas book with some maps and photos. So the reason why I'm showing you these instead of just sticking them in the kitchen is that that's the concentration of the topic tonight, but also I want to encourage you to invest in this sort of thing yourself for your own private library, because many Christians I know barely read the Bible and maybe never read the Bible. But as you start to read the Bible and get into it, you soon realize that you need some supplemental material to help think through some things and things like that. So I'm sure many of you have books like this, but if you don't, please buy yourself an atlas and some other books that I have in the back, including Bible Interpretation. There's a big, thick one. And the other one on archaeology. Some Bibles, like my Bible back home, it has a archaeological supplement in the back, and it's just tons of material on all tons of archaeological stuff. So if you don't have that in your Bible, go for it and get a book like that. You could buy, again, take a photocopy or a picture of the cover of this book and send it to yourself as a reminder. And then one last thought on that was, I can't remember now. Sorry. Okay. If you don't have a spiral-bound book and you want to borrow one for tonight and pay me at the break, let me know. Does anybody need that right now? If you do, there's some up here. Just pick it up. Pay me at the break or after. And I think that's it by way of announcements. All right. We'll pass out the attendance thing last after the break. If you were here last week or the second week or the first week, whatever, and you didn't check your box, feel free to check it for those weeks past. That's just fine. So, all right. Anybody new tonight? Maybe I should ask that. All right. Thank you. Welcome. Was that an applause for him, Sean? Wow. There you go. You're the first person to ever get applause for showing up.
Welcome.
All right, so, and help yourself again to the snacks at the break. You know, I'll go ahead and pass the attendance around now that I think about it. And if you didn't sign up to bring snacks, feel free to put your name there. We'd love to have 4 people per slot, if possible, per week. And if you can do that, that'd be great. If not, that's totally fine. But we'd love the participation. Okay, we're good. So, last week's stuff. We finished up on how the textual variants in the manuscripts do not have any impact on our theological system in any way, shape, or form. Nor do they even speak to any theological doctrine and render it skeptical or confusing. So we don't need to be skeptical of these textual variants in the Bible because of the textual variants. And this is a big deal. This is the main point of this whole conversation of looking at the manuscript evidence and seeing if the textual variants cause us to distrust the Bible. They don't. So that's kind of where we ended up last week. And I wanted to say a few more words on that. Again, in your handout, one of the missing items was the Bart Ehrman quote. Bart Ehrman conceded this point, but only in the appendix of his book, Misquoting Jesus. He conceded it. So he says, in his appendix, hidden back there where no one really reads it, essential Christian beliefs are not affected by textual variants in the manuscript tradition of the New Testament. Again, essential Christian beliefs are not affected by textual variants in the manuscript tradition of the New Testament. So here's the biggest critic of the Bible today. The guy who writes a ton of books, and they get on Barnes & Noble shelves, and he gets a ton of ink, if you will, on the internet because of his material that he's writing for popular culture. And this guy, in his appendix, is claiming the very thing that his book is trying to discredit, that the Bible is essentially reliable when it is producing doctrine. The Bible we have today is still reliable when it's addressing doctrinal issues. So this is a huge deal, and apparently this gets missed a lot by his minions on the internet. It's interesting that the entire book is making a case for why we should distrust the Bible and how theology has developed over time and how there is a high Christology that develops over centuries, and it's not there at the very beginning. It's a high view of the nature of Jesus, that Jesus was, in fact, God. And the critics claim that that was a legendary development over the many generations after the apostles. And that is one of the main criticisms. So despite this statement that he makes, all of his atheist and Muslim followers are thinking that he is discrediting Christian theology, and he has successfully discredited it. So it appears that Ehrman is the one misleading people and not the Bible. Although critics charge that the New Testament is twisting the text, it's just not the case. This is extremely overstated, and no doctrines have been tampered with. So, New Testament scholar F.F. Bruce says, and this is not in your notes, but you can just take this down, the variant readings affect no material question of historic fact or of Christian faith and practice. And this is one of the UK's best scholars of last century in his book, The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? Is in the back. It's a small little book. Again, he says, F.F. Bruce, the variant readings affect no material question of historic fact or of Christian faith and practice. So, we can conclude that Christian theology is not affected by the textual variants. And we looked at some of those last week, misspellings, a versus an in front of a word, things like that. I hope what I'm talking about right now is bringing to memory some of the things we discussed. I know it feels like forever ago, probably since last Thursday, but we all were here, so somehow we will remember. Now, at the top of page 37, there is a nice little graphic like this. Again, page 100 at the upper right-hand corner. And you can see in the graphic, on the right-hand side, there's some boxes pointing to the rows. And in the top row is the first generation, if you will, the autograph. So the autograph is there. Okay, so the second row is the first generation. So let's just kind of go with this for now and say that in each century, we have a generation of manuscripts, just to make it easy. So in the second century, we have the first set of copies. Well, if you look over to the right, the only Son of God is there, just like it is in the autograph at the top, the single autograph, again, in the first century. This is the New Testament author's handwritten, if you will, scroll on the scroll by the New Testament authors. That's the autograph. Again, no variation in the second century. Third century, look, we have one variation, the second one over to the right. The only is missing, if you see that in the bubble. The only is missing. So whereas the first generation had no variants, they copied correctly, the only Son of God, the only Son of God, only one time in the third generation is only missing. Then in the fourth century, you have the word only missing again in two of the manuscripts. So now the error is being duplicated, right? And then in the fifth century, you have several other errors being produced as that manuscript is copied down through the ages. This graphic is simply just trying to illustrate how textual variants develop over time. And so what's important about this is knowing that we have some of the, if we have these 5th century ones and we don't have the others, then we're in trouble before it. But we do have the others before, not the autographs, but we have several generations worth in between. Now this is very simplistic, it's showing 500 years worth of copying, but in reality there's several generations in between. And so the point is that one error can be propagated very quickly after so many years. It gets copied very quickly. And so again, what Ehrman and others try to do is say, see all of these differences between the text. There's no way to ever come to the original and know what the original said. And so let's talk about that. So this is kind of like the charge of the game of telephone. So if I give Dan a message and it goes through the rows here, by the time it gets into the back, we'd have a very garbled message and very different. So Dan Wallace, a textual scholar, he's authored some of the books in the kitchen there, he has gone to about 50 seminars and given an experiment basically with the people at the seminar. And what he would do is he would make up his own message of about 50 letters, 50 words. And he'd give it to the people in the front row. And these people would all be the scribes. And they would actually intentionally and unintentionally corrupt the message and pass that corrupted message to the row behind them. And so they did this on purpose to show essentially what that graphic is trying to show. So by the time it got to the second row, people already had something slightly different than the original, the one that Dan Wallace himself wrote. Then they took that and they continued to duplicate it to the rows behind them quickly and not very carefully so that there would be more errors developing through the generations. And by the time it went to the back row, they would have, say 50 to 100 manuscripts, if you will. So what's interesting is that they threw away the entire first row's manuscript. He had his autograph. He kept it. But they threw away all the scribes, say the first century's worth of manuscripts. And then they threw away the second century's worth of manuscripts, the second row, if you will. They only kept the third and the fourth. And then they took the third and the fourth, and they took them all and looked at them together as a group, and they were able to come back to the very original that Dan Wallace had in his shirt or in his pocket, just from the third and fourth century manuscripts alone. This is very much like our situation with the Bible. And what's interesting is we not only have the third and fourth, but we have the fifth, sixth, seventh. We have thousands of years worth of manuscripts. So we have a plethora of data to draw from. And the more manuscripts we have, the more errors that are produced. We talked a little bit about this last week. But also, the more evidence we have to arrive back at the original due to the multiplicity of the copies. And so it's easy to conclude that we can have confidence that we know what the original is saying. So that's what textual scholars do with their lives. They spend their lives trying to arrive at the content of the original. And like we talked about last time, there are the two standard Greek New Testaments that go above and beyond the footnotes in your English Bibles to give us even more textual variants that aren't displayed in the footnotes of our Bibles. And those will help us to have even more broader view of all the variants that are out there without being a textual scholar. So I gave you the names of those, the Nestle-Aland Greek New Testament and the United Bible Society Greek New Testament. So you can check those out if you like. So to respond to Ehrman and those who bring up the phone call game, or the phone transmission game, we simply need to tell them that we have access to several generations right up to the original, and because of the multiplicity of the copies, we can reconstruct the original. So we can, and the other thing is with the telephone game is the whole idea of that game is to laugh at the idea that it's messed up. So intentionally, as it goes through, usually the children are trying to make it funnier, right? And they're really intentionally trying to change it in some way as it passes through. And that's not what's happening here. The scribes sometimes intentionally tried to change a few things, and we talked about a couple places last time where they were trying to smooth it out and harmonize. But in general, scribes aren't sitting there trying to change the message. That's the opposite of their intent, to actually change the content. So the difference, again, between the telephone game and our situation with the manuscripts is that by the time it goes from point A to point Z, in the game, you don't have the in-between to cross-reference. But in our situation, we do. We have so many bits and pieces of fragments and full manuscripts that we can actually dive in and see just how it was transmitted and just what was the message when it got to her and when it got to him. And this is the biggest difference between and the best response for those who are online who give this telephone game criticism to the transmission issue. So we can consult the text, and we can verify, as the text was being transmitted through the generations, through the centuries, what the message was. So there's a very big difference here between our situation and the telephone game. Now, that's basically what you have on page 38. That's that material. And then we'll skip that part 3 at the bottom of page 38. And we'll go to the quote on page 39 by John Wenham on its part X, numeral X there. Why is it that in spite of the great diversity in our copies, the texts are still relatively homogeneous, John Wenham says. The only satisfactory answer seems to be that its homogeneity stems from exceedingly early text, virtually that is from the autographs. So the idea here is that we know that there is an original autograph and it says this because of the great diversity of the copies. If we didn't have a large amount of copies spread across all over the Mediterranean and they weren't producing little errors here and there, we wouldn't be able to really get at the material with full confidence, the original material. So Dan Wallace says, at bottom, Textual criticism for virtually all other ancient literature relies on creative conjectures or imaginative guesses at reconstructing the wording of the original. Not so with the New Testament. So when you're talking about textual criticism for other ancient documents, Plato, all of these other Roman historians, Livy, you're dealing with a lot of guesses when the material has breaks in it. And because we don't have a great diversity of copies, so we have to guess. And in with the Bible, we don't have to guess. We have so much data that it just points us to the right wording in the original autograph. So by way of conclusion, in light of these criteria, the criteria used by all other secular, sorry, let me start again. Used for all other secular ancient writings, the New Testament is the best attested work of the ancient world. That is, when compared to the other documents of the ancient world, we know with great certainty that the New Testament we have today is miraculously accurate to the original autographs. All right, so I believe that answers one of the last items in your fill in the blanks, right? From week 3. Right, so we didn't have enough time to go into the Old Testament manuscript transmission tradition. We did talk about the Masoretic text last week and the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Masoretic text is a highly produced, well-attested, high-quality set of manuscripts that were produced over about 1 million years by the Masoretic Jewish scribes. And they produced that pretty much in isolation during those years, and they did such a great job at it. But it's nowhere near as close to the original as what we have with the New Testament manuscripts. So then you have a big jump between the Masoretic text from about 6th century to the, I guess, 16th century, and all the way, then you jump all the way back to the Dead Sea Scrolls in the 1st century B.C., or 2nd century B.C. So you have a huge jump of 800 years where we don't have manuscripts from the Jewish tradition that are high quality. So, but the Dead Sea Scrolls kind of take care of that, the missing link, if you will. And they help us understand the differences between the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament, and the Masoretic text. So this essentially concludes the 39-page outline on the historical evidence that we have there. Okay? And so, did I miss any other fill-in-the-blank item that needs to be addressed? I don't think I did. If I did, let me know. She's asking about the statement in gray that says, so we can conclude that, we can summarize and say that for the New Testament, the 400,000 variants spread across 25,000 manuscripts are clustered and concentrated in particular passages. 3% are relatively significant and are included in the footnotes of the two standard Greek New Testaments. 1% are significant and are included in the footnotes of the English version. Okay? All right. So that essentially concludes that discussion, and we can move into other items of interest. Now, archaeology. Who likes archaeology? All right. Archaeology is a lot of fun as long as you're not digging it up. So keep that in mind. If someone is excited and really trying to recruit you to go on an apologetics trip to Israel to find some archaeological evidence, because you will be doing backbreaking labor in the hot summer sun, and it is not fun. I haven't done it, but I've done other types of digging in my past life, and I guess digging a ditch is what probably the hardest form of labor available. So, however, the fruit of that labor is highly significant to the Christian faith. And it matters so much. When you want to talk about scientific evidence for God, here we have, in a sense, scientific evidence for the Bible in terms of the Bible's reliability. So this is a big deal. Archaeological evidence is a big deal. Does everyone have the handouts for the week four? If you don't, I encourage you to go check it out in the back. Now, we're going to be on page 103 of the book, and it's 11-page handout, or it's 11-page outline there in the book. Again, upper right-hand corner, page 103. Now, if the magazines and the books are available, please have them be passed around and spread the word about those. So if you can send those, keep them moving, that'd be great. If the class sign-up list is stalled, please keep that moving. Now, I went to Israel a few years back with my brother on a sightseeing trip to have some fun. We actually hired a Jewish tour guide who was supposed to take us to Christian places, and he wound up taking us to more Jewish places than Christian. Not that there's a lot of difference between them, but once you get past, once if you're looking at a place that's only relevant to the last century, then it's a Jewish place. So when we went there, President Obama was just visiting Saudi Arabia and making a speech in Cairo, Egypt. And so this is several years back, and we picked up some local magazines as we walked by to find out what his speech was about and see the local reaction there in Israel, because Egypt's not so far away. Well, while learning about all these different extremist views and the Israeli leftist views on Obama's leadership and his positions on global issues, we wound up flipping through the newspaper and stumbled across some articles on archaeological digs that were happening in the local Jerusalem area. And it turns out that these articles, these entries, are very common in Israel, where you have reporters talking about the latest news in terms of what the archaeologists have dug up. And I'm sure you may have seen these if you've ever been to Israel, and you probably picked up some newspapers and know what I'm talking about. So, by show of hands, who's been to Israel? Oh, several of us. All right. Right on. So a lot of this will be hopefully not new to you, and hopefully you had a great trip and learned a lot about it. And so what's interesting is that archaeology is part of the culture there. It's part of the nation. It's about reclaiming their identity as an Israeli people, as a Hebrew people. And so the discoveries of the last century with the Dead Sea Scrolls, with Jericho and the walls and all of these other things around Israel, scholars are excited about all that, but they're even more excited about what's to come because there's a lot of digs still going on. And so it's exciting for us too as Christians, because the more they dig, the more we have in terms of evidence. We have a lot of evidence already, but we're going to continue to amass the evidence as the years go by. So, starting your outline, acknowledging and learning archaeology is very important in one's study of the available empirical data pointing to the truth-telling nature of the Bible. So, archaeology is very important to Christians. Archaeology is such an important component of our Christian apologetics, but it is often overlooked by apologists and evangelists. Most Christian apologists don't spend a lot of time on archaeology, which is very unfortunate. There's little denying the evidence that validates the Christian faith through the archaeological finds. Everyone that looks at what they dig up can easily see there's a connection to the Bible. The skeptical scholars try to reject that connection right away, but there is an implied connection, even if it's not explicit, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. So it's one thing to claim a history and really, truly, truly believe it. But later on, upon investigation, if we find that history never actually took place, then our belief system is really not grounded. Consider Mormonism, for instance. While reading the Book of Mormon, if you've done so, you may find it to be very, very similar to the Old Testament. Very similar. Not only does it use strange old King James Bible type of language, Victorian English in some places, to present it as if it was written 300 years before in 1500 in England, even though it was written in 1850. Even though it deceives on that level, it deceives on a whole nother level, because it tries to give a history that never happened. It tries to give a foundation for the faith of Mormonism that never took place. And this is not only appalling, but it's disgusting. It really is disgusting, because that book is being used to tell people how to live their life and how to prepare for the future and the afterlife, when its very foundation is suspect. And it completely is a farce. So it's important to know that the history in our Constitution, if you will, our Bible, is reality. It's important to know that the history really actually did happen. If it didn't happen, then we are in the same place as the Mormons. We are in the same place as the Mormons. If we lack evidence historically, then we have problems, Christians. We have problems. So, if you ever wanted to get angry, read the Book of Mormon, because you will hopefully realize quickly that it's trying so hard to be true, and that's the issue, is that it's trying to be a lie. It's trying its best to deceive. That's why I use the word disgusting. So beneath the surface that we walk on, the dirt itself has already given up volumes of evidence, and more evidence is waiting for us to dig it up. So the Christian faith has already been blessed and has flourished because of archaeological finds, especially in the last 150 years. So the ground literally grounds our belief, and thank you, God, for archaeology. This is very important. We have really great historical evidence. So when we're talking about the historicity of the scriptures, when we're talking about science, when we're talking about other forms of evidence, we want to use these and harness these pieces of evidence to marshal our arguments and present our position compellingly to the non-believers. Because the non-believers want evidence. Presuppositional apologetics doesn't work. People need evidential apologetics. Evidence is important. So this is one of the clearest forms of evidence that we can provide and present to help people understand that the events and history in the Bible is literal. So many keys of our past have been provided by digging up the ground. And when we were in Israel, there is a fella on our trip from Yale Divinity School. He was getting his MDiv degree, Masters of Divinity. So for those that know, that's one of the biggest degrees you can get in preparation to be a pastor or a scholar in seminary. And he was being sent there by Yale University as part of his training to be a scholar and a pastor, to go to the archaeological sites and dig himself. So this is part of the historical module within the Yale curriculum on your way to be a pastor or a scholar. You have to go to Israel and be a part of an archaeological dig. So Yale gets it. Yale knows that it's important. And I wish that many other apologetics organizations and churches realize this as well. So, many events, places, and people that some scholars once dismissed as fiction have been uncovered and evidenced as fact, confirming biblical accounts. So we'll look at a few of those. Now, Preliminarily, we should say that not all pieces of evidence that are dug up from the ground are readily agreed upon once they are looked at by archaeologists and scholars. There is a bit of debate that happens. However, people that typically are on the non-Christian side of things or non-Jewish side of things, their presuppositions tend to be diminished quickly as the reality of the evidence hits them. So yes, they do come with their presuppositions and be dismissive of it in terms of its connections with the Bible, but truly their presuppositions are influencing them, and once the evidence gets worked out and worked on, they typically get won over. Many archaeologists who once were skeptical at the Bible's reliability have changed their position. And you could look through internet history books, whatever, and you could find that there are many scholars and archaeologists that have been won over to the Bible's reliability after they've looked at archaeological evidence. So, what typically happens when you're looking at archaeological evidence is you follow this path known as abductive reasoning. If you've been in my classes in the past, we've talked about abductive reasoning before. And does anybody know or remember or could explain abductive reasoning? Would like to take a stab at it? Okay, well, abductive reasoning, A-B-D-U-C-T-I-V-E, has to do with the idea of generating multiple hypotheses to explain a variety of data. So when you have, say, a heap of data, and you're trying to explain how it got there, what's it for, the background, the intention, all these things, you generate a multitude of hypotheses, say 10, 20, whatever. And out of the, say, 10 or 20 hypotheses, you pick the best one based on certain criteria. So if the hypothesis has the most explanatory power or the most explanatory scope, if it's not ad hoc, things like this, then that hypothesis will start to look more and more attractive. And the most attractive hypothesis is usually the one that you say is the one you're going to hold to, because we want our beliefs to be based on a series of reasonable decisions and reasonable thinking. So we use abductive reasoning all the time. We use it when we're trying to diagnose the issues with a car. Judges use it and lawyers use it all the time in their cases in the courtroom. So the archaeologist uses abductive reasoning to attempt to explain the series of data that he's just uncovered. So he can say that this pot and this group of pottery is produced by the Hittites, or this spear was produced by the Philistines, or this little structure is the tomb of Joseph. You know, things like this. What is the hypothesis for what they're looking at? What are the groups of hypotheses? And they generate those, and then they get to the best one. So that's what's happening with abductive reasoning. It's not a deductive sort of proof. So this evidence doesn't prove the Bible's reliability in terms of a certainty, but it points us to the conclusion with confidence as we gather more and more evidence. The more and more evidence we have, the more attractive certain hypotheses become. Now, archaeological evidence of the Old Testament. Let's go there. Let's see here. Is there anything in this PowerPoint? That would be nice if there's some content here. Okay, we're at the end of the PowerPoint, everyone. Good job. You made it through. It went by fast. I don't know if that's a good thing or bad thing. So we'll go through a first few slides, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back and look at the rest. Isn't that exciting? That's the best part of this PowerPoint, by the way, is the transitions. Okay, so we talked about this. Look at that. technology. Yeah. Yeah. Is it chance or physical necessity or design? Okay. Yeah. Wow, you guys are good. Irreducible. Wow. Look at all these apologetics jokes. Does that mean we're nerds or what? All right, so we start looking into archaeology. We start having to talk about the Egyptians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Canaanites, Hittites, all these sorts of folks. And so you may be inundated with old stuff by the time you leave here. Hopefully you don't have the dust on you and coughing it up. Now, what I'd like to do first is just move this so I could be in a better spot to connect with you all. Let's do that. Yeah, okay. Everybody's happy.
It's a good thing you had a good hold on that.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to look at these things. Sorry. Apparently, I skipped to the end again somehow. I'll try not to touch that button. So we're going to look at a few things, starting here. The flood, the Sodom and Gomorrah, the Dead Sea Scrolls. We've talked about the Dead Sea Scrolls, so we won't spend a lot of time there. We'll talk about the flood more once we get to the Gilgamesh epic later, so I'll go ahead and skip to... I'll go through a picture just to give you a picture of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and then we'll talk a little bit about Sodom and Gomorrah, and then we'll talk about all of these things. So Adam and Eve, Amarna tablets, this is just a quick list, and this is the list you have in your notes. So if you're in your book, you're going to see that it becomes a list really quick on page 3 of 11, and that's what I'm showing you right here in these first few intro slides. And after that, you can flip over to your handout for tonight, which will have the PowerPoint here and a place for you to take notes on the right. So it's a few pages in after all those timelines, which we'll talk about after the break. So if you flip through the first few pages of your handout for tonight, there's a PowerPoint set there of pictures and a place on the right-hand side to fill in the blank. Okay? All right, so now the flood picture is blank. Do you know why? Because I'm trying to show you what it looks like to be in a flood. So there's nothing too exciting there.
But are we under the
water? We're under the water at this point, yeah. So this is the flood picture right here. All right, so there you are. The water's blue back then. In ancient Israel, you get the idea. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, we talked about last week, this is an actual image of a Dead Sea Scroll from the museum itself. They put this on the internet. It's part of some of your materials or at least part of some Facebook pages. That image is there. And the idea with this is that you could see for yourself the clarity of it. The clarity of it. This is a 2,000-year-old document. Can you believe that? No, it's like barely withered away in terms of the area around the content. This is amazing. This is amazing. So I wish I had this last week when we were really talking about it, but you can't get any clearer than that if you're even writing it today. Some of us write much messier than that and on back of the envelope and coffee spills on it, and you can't make it out. So this is truly remarkable. I think God really did preserve this for us today. So, oh darn it, I hit end again. Sorry. I'm not a PowerPoint guy. I just never was. Yeah, I have one here. Okay, Sodom and Gomorrah. So Sodom and Gomorrah used to be, it used to be thought that Sodom and Gomorrah was on the south side of the Dead Sea. And the south side of the Dead Sea was for hundreds and hundreds of years the traditional location of Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, recently, even within the last decade, the location of Sodom and Gomorrah has been reevaluated. And a guy, I'll get to his name here in a second, but you can see here at the top of the Dead Sea, the north side of the Dead Sea, is where Sodom and Gomorrah now is thought to be, according to Stephen Collins' research. He's an archaeologist, I believe, out of Canada. And you can see there the Jordan River coming down into the top of the Dead Sea. Again, this is east of Jerusalem, and Jordan is to the north part of the page, or the screen, and Israel's to the southern part. And you can see there just a variety of different things happening. And I actually got these slides from Stephen Collins himself. And so I didn't put these together. But what he's trying to show is this is the region described in Genesis around the chapters of dealing with Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah. And here he's identifying all of the other towns that would have been in existence in those years around Sodom and Gomorrah. And by the description in Genesis, he's able to locate towns based on this location. So when you put all the pieces together like a puzzle, he's able to say that, see, once you look at the biblical data, and once you put Sodom and Gomorrah here at the top of the Dead Sea, all of these other places around it that I talked about and described in Scripture seem to make sense. And so then you have other places that fall into place with this hypothesis of Sodom and Gomorrah being on the north side of the Dead Sea. He calls them Tal, such and such. Usually they're referred to as Tel, such and such. And this is just a way to understand towns or these mounds, if you will, these little hills that develop over the centuries of people, civilizations coming in and building towns on top of each other, and kind of turns into this big mound or hill, if you will. So they use the word Tel when they're describing these things back there. This is a view looking northwest from Mount Nebo, and there's a reservoir. And what he's doing is he's pointing to this area right there where he believes these were the locations of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, what's exciting about that is you have a great place for us to do more research with. And so what he found there was pottery that looked like it was burnt, as if it went through an explosion. He found skeletons and other bones as if they were thrown away from a central point in the town area, as if the bodies had been, transmitted as a projectile, if you will, and found in that kind of form, in that kind of layout. And a few other pieces of the building materials that were shattered and how they how they were found suggested as if they were being collapsed from the top down, as if something was bombing it. And so this type of evidence is very telling and points to the picture that these two locations were in fact the original locations of Sodom and Gomorrah. And he wrote a book on it, and you can just type in his name, Stephen Collins, Sodom and Gomorrah, it'll come up. So that's kind of fun and exciting. So we'll leave it at that for now. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to look at a few of the timelines that I gave you, and we're going to go through the rest of these beautiful pictures. So 5 minutes from now, let's come back in. All right, thanks. Okay, let's get going here. What we're going to do is I'm going to kind of play on two computers for your entertainment. I didn't realize the newer computer doesn't have the right connection to the machines back here, so I have to use the older computer, which means I had to get the PowerPoint on there, but I have my notes over here. So I'm happy, everything's fine. Hopefully you'll be happy. And we'll do this together. Teamwork. So, Adam and Eve seal. Let's start there. Oh, before we start there, let's talk about the handouts. Who likes handouts? Yay. So, I spent a lot of time scanning and producing high-quality plagiarism for you this past week. So I hope you will be pleased with my lying and cheating and stealing efforts that I've done that for you. I've lost some jewels in my crowns in heaven so that you could be edified and everything. So if you go to the first handout I gave you, it was a Old Testament chronology, and you would have saw, I must have left mine on the copier. Yeah, that's it. Can I borrow?
Yeah.
So if you look here, there's the Old Testament one, and then there's another one that has the New Testament stuff. Sorry, I left mine on the copier. I'm going to grab one in the back so I don't take yours. Ben. Hey. Yeah. Oh, excuse me, Jim. Thanks. Okay, so that's what it's like to be outside during class. Okay, so the Old Testament history in high-quality printing plagiarism here. On one side, it shows you the different events that took place written about in the Bible explicitly, and then over there on the right, you have places and different events from other nations besides Israel. And hopefully you have things like this at your disposal already at home, but if you don't, feel free to utilize this one and make the best of it, because it really does help. And I would encourage you to even mark on it and put like a line and say, oh, this is when such and such happened in the Bible. And when your pastor's talking and different things like that, sometimes your Bible will allude to different dates that the books were written. Stick some notes on this and make it a working document for yourself. Yes, sir.
So I do actually have a question. Always just a question I have. Okay, so on this timeline, so this shows that a fall occurred about 4,000 years ago, which would mean that the 4,000 BC, which would mean that there's about 6,000 years of history. Okay? Mm-hmm. Then this shows in 1491, the Exodus.
I'm an engineer, so I do the same thing.
Just over 200 years later, mm-hmm. 72 people turned into like 2 million people that left Egypt.
Well, the Israelites were enslaved for 400 years, and they were like rabbits multiplying.
Now that
makes me scratch my head even more. Mm-hmm.
Because
this says 1406 to 1491. That's not 400 years. Okay. Let me.
I'm sorry.
Let me take a step back. Well, they did have multiple wives, but that's another story. Yeah.
That's really my question.
I guess in 400 years, because that's what it talks about. Now, but let me paraphrase the. Let me go back and give you the disclaimer. Up at the top it says, there is no generally accepted system of Bible chronology. That's important to know, because everyone differs in how they date things in the Bible. This guy, Bishop Usher, 300 years ago, tried to work out when creation was. So he put it at 4004 BC on the dot. And that's pretty much impossible to arrive at that kind of a conclusion and be that specific. But what he did was he took a very literal interpretation of all the genealogies throughout Scripture, especially in the Old Testament, and including the two in the New Testament, and he got to this point. Now, Bishop Usher has long been, or this timeline produced by him has long been discredited. I give it to you, though, because generally speaking, it gives you an indication of how things progressed. What is a really good number to keep in mind is the exile happened around Jeremiah's time to Babylon around 500 BC, 586 BC. That's a pretty hard, straight number that most scholars, biblical and non-biblical, hold to. David and Solomon lived around 1000 BC. And then you have Moses around 1500. So if you go back 500 years at a time, you have the Babylonian exile around there. You have David and Solomon at 500 years before that at the 1,000-year mark, BC. Moses at 1,500 years-ish. And then Abraham around 2,000 years. So these key biblical figures, Abraham, Moses, David, and the Babylonian exile, around the 500-year marks. And that gives you a good indication of how generations progressed. I would stick to that general outline in your mind. And then if you start reading different biblical scholars, they'll have different dates. So I have several books back there, and I bet you they all differ on their exact dates. But the Babylonian exile, in terms of the last Nebuchadnezzar's last gathering of the Jews to take them to Babylon, is 586, and that's pretty that's a solid number, 586 BC. And then you work from there backward. Now, that just to give you a little background on this particular chart. Now, there's another chart that gives you more dates on the next page. So there's more fun here if you look and see where the main players are in relation to the timeline. Okay? So you have David and Solomon right in the middle. You have the split of the two kingdoms right in the middle of the page. You have Nehemiah and Ezra coming back from the Babylonian exile. Around the 500-year mark, and again Abraham over there on the left, on the left-hand side, and a whole bunch of cool things there at the bottom for your viewing pleasure. So, A-N-E, by the way, at the bottom, A-N-E, you'll see that nomenclature a lot. Those abbreviations just stand for Ancient Near East. So scholars, when they talk about the area of Palestine, they call it Ancient Near East. And they've been doing that for a long, long time. So when you write online or when you write something or do a Bible study, use the words Ancient Near East, because there's more Oriental and Middle Eastern sorts of phenomena happening during the Bible times than there is Western phenomena. So our world is very, very, very different from theirs. So we tend to want to put it in its appropriate category, if you will. So Ancient Near East is more appropriate than thinking of it as Israel or Palestine or something like that when you're talking about that era. So Ancient Near East, A-N-E. And then the next page is a little bit more advanced, and we don't need to spend a lot of time here, but this is from one of the more scholarly books back there. It's called The Reliability of the Old Testament, written by Kitchen. He's a big-time scholar of the Old Testament, and he'll go on and on and on about tons of details, but very highly, a very great authority on the New Testament. So we don't need to cover that, but if you want to dig into more scholarly archaeological stuff, I encourage you to look into that chart. And then we have in your handout the 12 pages of the PowerPoint, and then at the end, the last few pages, you have another one of these diagrams, tables, and basically it tells you about the period between the Old and New Testament, which doesn't get talked about in Protestant circles much at all. So the period before the Old and New Testament is something that most Christian evangelicals just don't know much about at all, and that's why I assigned in the recommended reading a book out of the Apocrypha. I put Tobit there, but you could read Maccabees or other books that talk about the history between Malachi at the end of the Old Testament and Matthew at the beginning of the New Testament, that 400-year period is not a period of silence as Protestant evangelicals like to think of it as. They say that God was not speaking in terms of how he was speaking before and after this 400 years, but there is a lot of activity happening in Israel, namely the Greeks are taking over and barbecuing pigs on the altar in Jerusalem, things like that. And then after Matthew starts, there you have the New Testament history beginning, Roman supremacy, and then you can kind of match this up with events in the New Testament. So it's good to keep in mind the external context of the times when you're reading your Bibles. I always have these in my Bibles, so I encourage you to just fold them up and put this bad boy in there, put all these guys in there and take them with you to church, pull it out when your pastor starts talking about a book and use it. The next one about the church fathers and early church history, we'll get into that more in the next couple weeks, but that's there for you now. And there's a few different diagrams there to help you know who the main players were and when they were living. And so I don't want to bombard you with timelines, but I wanted to give them to you all at once because they are very helpful in my opinion. All right, moving on to pretty pictures. We have the Adam and Eve seal. Now, the Adam and Eve seal. Now, again, there's no fill in the blanks. There's no descriptions in your books. You're just going to take notes if you want to on the little lines next to the pictures on your handouts. If you don't want to, it's totally fine. We'll just have fun together. All right. Now, this was found in 1932 by a scholar of Assyrian history named Spicer. He's from University Museum of Pennsylvania. He found it at the Tepe Gerah Mound, 12 miles from Nineveh. And this is up in the northern part of the Palestinian area where the Assyrian capital would have been in Nineveh. And the seal is very small. It's only about 1 inch. It's engraved in stone and is showing a naked man and woman slightly bent over. Some say it shows them as if they're in a bit of humiliation. And some scholars suggest that it reflects Adam and Eve. People date this as far back as 3500 BC, which would be closer to Adam and Eve. Some date it around 2000 BC. And the great thing about this is that there is some sort of picture or some sort of documentation, if you will, if you want to call it that, of two men and women with a tree in between them and a snake around them. You can see the serpent there and there. And it gives you the sense that they're in the Garden of Eden. So, is it Adam and Eve? Was it created by Adam and Eve? No. But it seems to suggest that that story was around and prior to even Moses. So, even if it's as late as 2000 BC, it still was prior to Moses. So that's interesting. If it's as far back as 3500 BC, it suggests that that story was propagated verbally, as most stories were at the time, and some folks somehow, just some way or another, decided to write it down in a pictured form. Now, this is in the British Museum at the moment. The Amarna tablets, 1400 BC, these were found in Egypt in 1880 by a peasant farming the land. So somebody is cruising around digging for his crops, and I think it was a woman at the time in 1880, and this was around the capital city that Pharaoh Amenhotep made, and his capital was not in Thebes. It was somewhere else, and this farmer found the royal archives of Amenhotep's capital by just digging the soil. And later on, an English Egyptologist, William Matthew Flinders Petrie, in 1891, found the rest of the tablets. This one was one of those tablets he found. Total, they found 382 cuneiform tablets of writing from government officials throughout the ancient Near East, written to Pharaoh. So these would have been tablets that arrived at the capital to Amenhotep himself from his government officials throughout the ancient Near East who had outposts. Some of them were letters just telling Pharaoh what was going on. Others were letters, talking about crisis at hand. Some of the letters reference biblical cities: Ashkelon, Gaza, Gezer, Hazor, Joppa, Lachish, and Megiddo. And so when you have these cities that the Bible talks about in the Old Testament being referenced by an Egyptian government official in a writing to Pharaoh himself, then there is a great deal of historicity added to the reality that that biblical city existed. Now, the most intriguing tablet that was found was a letter from an Egyptian government official stationed at the Jerusalem outpost of the Egyptian Empire at the time, named Abdi Hiba. And he was stationed there during the time of Joshua's invasion, scholars say. And one of the letters written on clay tablets talks about an army of archers coming, or he asked Pharaoh to bring an army of archers to come and help them against the invading army, which would have been the Israelites coming across the Jordan into the Canaan territory. And he says the Habiru, H-A-B-I-R-U, and some put a K before the H. So K-H-A-R-I-B-U, Habiru, sounds like Hebrew. The Habiru, the Hebrew, are capturing the forces of the king, he says in his tablet. May the king care for his land. And he goes on to say exactly what's happening. They've taken other cities in the area. And if the Habiru isn't Hebrew, then there's still a connection. And even non-biblical scholars have actually identified the Habiru as a name given in the ancient Near East for foreign mercenaries or peasants who are a peasant class revolting against the king. So it would be just that. So somebody calling some Elite of the area saying that there's a revolt taking place, you've got to get over here, the peasants are attacking. They look like a bunch of thugs from some nearby territory. Oh, I like that. Okay, sorry. If you're watch the Super Bowl, did anybody not watch the Super Bowl? Oh my gosh. Wow. Okay, good game. So this still most likely points to Joshua and the Israelites conquering Canaan, even if the Habiru isn't Hebrew particularly, but it still relates to an incoming class of citizens who tend to be poor and trying to cause a bunch of destruction and take over, which is what the Israelites were trying to do at the time. Question. Yes. Haribu. Oh, sorry. Yes, you're right. It's Habiru.
Yeah, okay, so.
Sorry. Well, I don't speak ancient Egypt language. That's for sure. Habiru. That makes more sense. Okay, thank you. And so the next thing we're going to talk about is the Babylonian Chronicles. A similar clay tablet was found around Babylon. It was found after excavations in the 19th century. It's currently housed in the British Museum. Many of these items are housed in the British Museum, which in fact is one of the world's greatest museums. And if you ever have a chance to go there, I'd recommend it. Tablets like these were very important in terms of delivering messages at the time in the ancient Near East. And this tablet here that's shown is one of which that reports the history of Babylon during the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar. And these tablets around that time date around 550 to 400. So slightly after Nebuchadnezzar's rule, the historians were at work. And these tablets reveal Nebuchadnezzar's armies invading the Palestinian region, which we hear about in Jeremiah and 2 Chronicles. So when Jeremiah is lamenting in Lamentations and when he's prophesying in the book of Jeremiah, he's dealing with the Babylonian invasion by King Nebuchadnezzar. And so these tablets are very important because they give us extra biblical evidence that corroborates the scriptures on the historical nature of the events that took place that the Old Testament is describing. In 2 Chronicles 36:9, there's an explicit reference to the Babylonian invasion. Of course, it's throughout the book of Jeremiah. In December 598, as it says this in one of these tablets, in December 598 BC, no, it doesn't say this. They didn't date things like that. This is a scholar saying this. In December 598 BC, as Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, had ceased to pay tribute, Nebuchadnezzar's army besieged Jerusalem and captured it on the 15th day of March in 597 BC. The new king of Judah, Jehoiachin, was captured and carried off to Babylon. So again, when I talked about 586 BC, you're dealing with a very good, reliable date of when the final group of the Jews were carried off into Babylon. There's a few remaining folks, the remnant, as they are called, in Jerusalem, but very, very few. Most of everybody was in Babylon or Assyria and scattered around. So there's really no one left in Jerusalem until Darius issues his decree to send them back to Jerusalem to re-inhabit the city and rebuild the temple. Now, the next guy we have here is the Behistun inscription. This was also known as the inscription by King Darius, the king of Persia, again, who came in and invaded Babylon and defeated, I think, Nebuchadnezzar II and Belshazzar. Yeah. And so Darius came in and essentially freed the Jews of their captivity in Babylon, sent them back to Babylon to rebuild the temple. And this monument there on the cliff edge, if you go a little closer, you can see a little bit more detail and the writing that would be right here. There's a bunch of text. There's text here and text here, and there's text all over the place. And when you zoom in, it gets really detailed, very, very high quality lettering there in the stone. And this is around this area that has more monuments like it. And this dates to 500 BC when King Darius took over. Again, this tablet provides independent evidence of the historical account written in Daniel. And when Ezra and Nehemiah went back to build the temple in Jerusalem, this, again, points to the historicity of those events that are described there because we have it from an extra-biblical source. And what's exciting about this is that Darius essentially gave the Jews a second life, and that ushered in the way for Jesus as they inhabited Jerusalem from about 500 B.C. to the time of Jesus. So that's kind of the period, if you will, of silence that Protestants like to say, where the Apocrypha was written that the Catholics have in their Bible. Now, the Belshazzar inscription also referred to as Nabonidus's cylinder. I hope I'm saying that right. Nabonidus was one of the kings of Babylon after Nebuchadnezzar. He was the father of Belshazzar. Belshazzar was written about in the book of Daniel. This cylinder was discovered in 1854 by Henry Rawlinson. He was the writing in this particular monument. It was cuneiform, and it was based on the area of Ur, where Abraham came out of. So when you talk about Ur, that's kind of the birthplace, if you will, of the writing of the ancient Near East. So the oldest writing that we have from the ancient Near East comes from Ur. So there's a lot of these sorts of things that are found there in that ancient city. And it talks about Belshazzar. Many scholars thought that Belshazzar was made up, and it didn't make sense when Daniel said he was the third most important ruler in Babylon. Well, he was telling the truth. Instead of saying he was the second most important, he was the third, because Nabonidus' son was Belshazzar. And so this guy here talks about the existence of Belshazzar. So again, the Bible has been confirmed, even though scholars were skeptical about it. And Daniel does speak accurately when he talks about being the third highest ruler in Babylon. The black obelisk of Shalmaneser, he was the king of Assyria, and this nice monument here was written to describe some of his war escapades in and around Palestine, and it is housed in the British Museum also. If you zoom in, you can see more graphic detail, especially right here. You see King Shalmaneser right there, and he has a nice hat, some cool dreads. He's got a beard, and he looks like he's Rastafari because he's smoking something. I'm not quite sure, but sandals go with that. And then you have the king of Israel doing what? He's bowing down to King Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria, who had came in and invaded Israel, which is the northern kingdom. If you look on that first timeline, you'll see the kingdom split after Solomon, Rehoboam, and Jeroboam. And then you have the northern kingdom, which is called Israel, and that retains the Israel name. The Judah would be the southern kingdom, housed out of Jerusalem. And so the northern kingdom was swept away with the Assyrian invasion. And Jehu is bowing down to him right here. And that's the king of Israel there. And this was discovered in modern-day Iran in 1901. I take that back. That's the next one. This is discovered in 1846 by Henry Layard, and it was excavated from Nimrod, which was, if you remember, Nimrod is the ancient city described in Jonah. Jonah talks about, in Genesis, we're talking about the Tower of Babel in Nimrod. And this was discovered in northern Iraq. And these relief carvings show the results of five battles of the Assyrian king, Shalmaneser III. And that Assyrian king received tribute from nearby kings of the area. So he would attack them, they would pay tribute, so like a tax, so that he wouldn't completely demolish them. Kind of like a mafia leader would, a mafia godfather would. And so this is the only relief showing an Israelite king. So this is very, very important. Again, bowing down there. And this picture doesn't get that detailed, but it's that's who it is, because it's described elsewhere in the monument. It reads, "The tribute of Jehu, son of Omri, who is also an Israelite king. I received from him silver, gold, a golden vase, and a pointed bottom, golden tumblers, golden buckets, tin, a staff for a king, and spears." So here's the list of items that Jehu brought to the king after the king invaded and took all the Israelites away. And it mentions him specifically, Jehu, son of Omri. So when you go into your Bible and you look in the book of Kings, you will find this very same thing described. So again, adding further attestation of the history books, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, and showing their historicity is confirmed outside of the Bible. The Code of Hammurabi, 1700 BC. So this particular monument was discovered in 1901 in modern-day Iran. Hammurabi was the sixth Babylonian king who reigned over Mesopotamia from around 1792 to 1750 BC. So this was kind of old Babylon before Nebuchadnezzar was around there. So this was like when Babylon was great the first time. And so this Hammurabi code represented one of the oldest, most sophisticated legal writings that we have uncovered. The code was very much like the Torah, the Hebrew law, written in Leviticus. Wow. Yeah, all right. So this is 7 feet tall. It's got law all over it, just carvings, writing everywhere, all over, in very small detail. It predates the Mosaic Law by about 200 years, and there's 282 total laws related to commerce and trading and religion, and it's written in the Akkadian language. So that's one of the oldest languages around. And until this find, it was thought that as far back as 1500 AD, Moses and Israel were not advanced enough to have thorough laws, like is shown in the Torah. So many scholars dated the Torah much later and didn't date it to Moses' time. And so this excavation showed that there were laws, and they were thorough, already in existence in the ancient Near East, around the region during that time of Moses. And as a result, this gives weight to the traditional view, which held that the Torah was actually, can easily be placed in the time of Moses. Now, interestingly, you can do with this what you want. It includes the statement, if a man puts out the eye of another man, his eye shall be put out. So this reminds you of an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, written in the Torah. The Torah is the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, Deuteronomy. The next item we're going to look at is the Cyrus cylinder here. And this cylinder, again, talks about King Cyrus. It was discovered in the 1880s in the Babylon, in the ruins of Babylon in modern-day Iraq area. It's smaller than the size of a football, and it's written in Babylonian cuneiform again on clay. This is after Cyrus invaded Babylon. Cyrus was the king of Persia around 559 to 530 BC, and he conquered Babylon around that time, and while reigning there, he set the Jews free. And I think I'm getting this mistaken with Darius, so excuse me, but I believe it's Cyrus. The decree of Cyrus. So he's the one that actually had the decree. All right, so it mentions the Jews as part of this plan, and it's described in 2 Chronicles 36 and verse 22. Again, 2 Chronicles 36, 22 and Ezra 1:1, which reads, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved on the heart of King Cyrus of Persia to make a proclamation throughout his realm and also to put it in writing. This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says. I'm reading from the Bible now, and this, again, it corroborates well with this. This is what Cyrus said in his decree. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judah. Any of his people among you may go to Jerusalem in Judah and build the temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem, and may be their God be with them. And in any locality where survivors may now be living, the people are to provide them with silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with freewill offerings for the temple of God in Jerusalem. And so forth. And they go back. And this is, again, perfect picture of corroboratory evidence of the events in the Old Testament. Now, if you go to that first timeline I gave you, I'd like for you to just write in right here, Cyrus's cylinder, or the cylinder of Cyrus. Just write that in on your first table there. Yeah, around 500 BC, the Jews go back. Jews return under Zerubbabel at the very near the very bottom. Mm-hmm. You see that? 535. So write that in and draw a picture of a football next to it and put Cyrus's cylinder and point to that football, and then you can have something in your mind to jog your memory that a big event like this is something that you could point to and do more research on. Now, this is just one example of you writing something in here. I encourage more of this. There's a lot more to go here. So we're running out of time, but I typically want to finish off before 9, between 8:45 and 9. So we're kind of in that moment. So we'll do a couple more, and then we'll see how much we can do next week, which will go into our next topic. So just bear with me. We'll kind of pick this up next week, but we'll do a couple more here. So the Ebla tablets. So if you recall your geography, you have Damascus here, Jerusalem would be around here, and then you have these other areas of Assyria. Now, it turns out the kingdoms have come and gone, and they've disappeared, and Ebla was one of such kingdoms that was pretty big and had a lot of people living there, around 260,000 at one point, and was before Abraham's time. So it would have been a very large metropolis for the ancient Near East, and there's Ebla right there. Now, these tablets were found that took painstaking, detailed information about the trade activities that happened in the city of Ebla, and they have documented the imports and exports that came out of the city, different amount of sheep, things like that. And you can see this is the city from a distance, city close up, some ruins there, and a more closer shot. And then you have the tablet. And then the tablets were found like this after they dug them up. And this was the archives where they had shelves made of wood, actually, and just like we would have them today. And the tablets stacked face to face with a piece of clay in between them that would act as a separator. And the ones that had the writing on them were thicker. And they were positioned not like where we have our books stacked like this. They had their tablets stacked like that. And when the invading army came and set fire to the city, the wooden shelves would have collapsed. The tablets would have came down and stacked in some way on top of each other or fallen. And I don't think these are the ones that had the shelves, but in another location they said they had found them as if they had just, the shelves had just collapsed, kind of like pancaked, if you will. And there was kind of, you know, ashes in between. And so the cool thing about these tablets is that they represent, there's 20,000 of them, by the way. They represent a lot of writing before Abraham's time. So again, before Moses, there's tons and tons of writing going on these clay tablets. They were dated between 2500 BC to 3000 BC. And again, if you remember from your chronology there, Abraham lived around 2000 BC. So this is before Abraham's time. Now, what's cool about these is that the language appears to be some form of a Hebrew type of language. It's not Hebrew, but it's like Hebrew. So that lends credibility to the development of the Hebrew language after the Tower of Babel fell. And these tablets represent names of biblical cities like Giza, Lachish, Joppa, Ashtara, and Megiddo, just like the other Egyptian tablets do. And so the places that the Bible talks about are attested here in this city's documentation. They also have Hebrew names such as Abraham, Israel, Ishmael, Esau, Saul, and David. So these names would have been around prior to the biblical characters having these names. They would have been in existence at the time. So it lends credibility to the historicity of these biblical figures because these names were already common during those eras and during that region. And also it talks about certain gods of the region. And so it seems to me to suggest that because they use the name El and Yah for God in some of these tablets, that El and Yah would have been a common name from folks who would have been descendants from Noah, who had the understanding of God, Elohim, El, Elohim, and had told their children and grandchildren about God after the days of Noah. And this verbal commitment of carrying on that story is how the people of Ebla heard of God and called God El and Yah. And again, Yah being short for Yahweh. So it may be in Moses' time, as God reveals himself more to Israel, we see more of a fuller picture of God and as he reveals himself to man. So theologians call this progressive revelation, where theology is becoming clearer and clearer, where morality and legal codes are provided by God as generations progress. So progressive revelation is very important to understand when we're talking about the laws in the Torah versus, say, Jesus' teaching. So as God would have revealed himself to the people of the earth prior to Moses, he would have hopefully had a consistent picture of God, and some of these tablets point to that. Now, it also talks about Sodom and Gomorrah and other cities around Sodom and Gomorrah. So these tablets are very, very helpful because Sodom and Gomorrah, of course, was around the time of Lot and Abraham. And so that lends credibility to those stories of Sodom and Gomorrah and Lot and Lot's wife and so forth. The first king of Ebla was named Ibram, E-B-R-U-M, if it's translated like that. Some translate it Eber, E-B-R-E-R, E-B-E-R. And Eber happens to be in the generational chronologies, one of the great-great-grandfathers of Abraham. Abraham came out of Ur, which is in the southern part of Mesopotamia, in that region, and this is more towards the north, but it's not too much of a big deal to think that after several generations, if Abraham's ancestors came out of Ebla, that Abraham would have migrated, those ancestors would have migrated down here to Ur, and then Abraham would have done his route like this up into the Palestinian region. And so if Eber was Abraham's great-great-great-great-grandfather, it would seem to add credibility to the idea that Abraham was a rich man, because Ebla was a very wealthy city. And if Eber was the king of Ebla, then he would have been very wealthy, and so would have had his descendants. And we know that Abraham had flocks and flocks of animals and people, and he was already in charge of a whole clan of folks when he was living in Ur. So this lends credibility to Abraham and his richness when we pick up the story in Genesis. And one of the tablets, and we'll finish with this, has a creation account. And in the creation account, it's the closest to the Genesis creation account than any other creation account in any other culture that we have found. And the creation account gives a basic, broad description that God created the earth, God created the light, God created the sun, if you will. I'm not sure if they used the word sun, you know, or what would have been their equivalent at the time. And so that creation account is very, in terms of its outline, in terms of what it speaks to, is very similar to the creation account in Genesis. So the Ebla tablets are very, very important in terms of archaeological finds, and it's a city that was once completely lost. Completely, it's like Atlantis sort of a thing. But what we've discovered out of this Atlantis, so to speak, has been very monumental. And so some put the discovery of Ebla to be on par with the Dead Sea Scrolls in terms of its significance in archaeology and what it tells us about the ancient Near East and the voids that it fills. So this is a big deal. And again, showed up out of nowhere, essentially. Now, it's nearby Aleppo, which, as you know, has been in the middle of the civil war in Syria. So hopefully there hasn't been too many raids to the site. It was excavated between 65 and, I think, 85, 1965, 1985. So I think most of the research was done. But from what I understand, they were saying that because the city was so vast, there's just hundreds and hundreds of areas to excavate. So hopefully no bombs hit the land and kind of destroyed the items underneath. So anyway, there's a little bit of background there for you, and I hope the pictures help. And it's not the most exciting PowerPoint presentation on the planet, but it's the best I can do. So sorry if it is more boring than you've ever experienced. Yes. Yeah.
Apparently, somebody else got it long before Moses.
Well, the
pre-Abraham.
Yeah. So why don't we do this as a thought experiment? Take this question home and chew on it. How did the creation story get to Moses? Was it given by God by divine dictation, where God superintended Moses' thoughts and it was written out? Or was it a tradition that Moses came across, which would have been around, obviously, if this is an accurate tablet interpretation, and the people of Eblo would have known about it too.
Out of both.
So, yeah, and maybe there's a combination of both. So let's chew on that. Why don't we close in prayer? Would someone like to close us? Yes. Thanks for volunteering.
Dear Lord, I thank you so much for this time and the incredible information that you're delivering to us here through Jeremy. And I pray a great blessing on him and on his family. Your holy and precious name we pray.
Amen. Thank you so much. We'll see you next week.